human beings are dwellers in two worlds. Our uniqueness amongst the creatures of the earth lies in this role that we have as half beast and half angel. A dynamic tension exists because of the contrary demands which living in each of these realms places on us. We experience this on a daily basis, an internal tug of war, pulling first in one direction, then to the opposite pole. Whenever we are called upon to make a choice, a decision, the earthly and the heavenly draw us one way or the other, and often both at once. We're going to pause right there. Hello, friends on Substack. If you're listening on a platform other than Substack, any resources that I mention or link are going to be in this article. Link to the article in the show notes. So for everybody, I was not planning on posting anything at all. But if I were to write this on Substack, it would be much more time than I have available and way too long. So I am reading to you, and that opening was the first paragraph of it. I am only going to read you the introduction into one of the works of Rudolf Steiner. If you are aware of who that is, great. If you are not, regardless of your belief, regardless of what you come from, regardless of what polarity you are in, or possibly somewhere in the middle, I would invite you to stick around to the end because it is not going in the direction that it sounds like it might be if you're not familiar with this work. I was unpacking what I thought was art supplies, and two of Rudolf Steiner's books fell out, and this was one of them. And long story short, I found myself now recording this to you. So enjoy it. Consider it a bedtime story, except it's about the human condition and makes a whole lot of sense out of what we feel like is a whole lot of madness. Madness is what I am saying. So there's some really good stuff in here. I'm only reading you the intro, which wasn't even written by Steiner. So, and heads up, there's going to be some things in here that I can't pronounce. So hang in there. Okay, so we will continue. And like I said, no matter what your beliefs are, hang tight, because where it ends, even in the introduction, is probably not what you would think, unless you're familiar with the work. Okay. A long-held view has been that, of course, one should always give way to the heavenly or spiritual. The alternative is to succumb to the earthly, the fallen, to evil. The struggle has been portrayed as white versus black, good versus evil. The enduring legacy of this attitude has been to deem the earthly, the bodily nature of the human being, as soiled, unclean, corrupt, and shameful. With this view, the spiritual aspirant of the past had no choice but to reject the body, the earth. In India, incarnating into a physical body has long been considered a curse, the entering into the, quote, veil of tears, which constitutes life. The physical body was especially singled out for punishment, to be starved and tortured, purged and scourged. St. Francis derided his body as his donkey, but reluctantly acknowledged that he must give it some care if it was to continue carrying him about. The medieval Cathars saw the human body as a pit into which the devil had lured the souls of weakened angels. Procreation was thus looked upon with horror, as an act of unwitting cruelty. Each new birth dragged a heavenly soul into the fallen world of matter, bringing another diabolically corrupt angel into the flesh. Even to study the physical body too closely was suspect. Hence Leonardo's need for secrecy in the dissection of corpses. The accumulation of an inordinate amount of the material realm in the form of wealth has also been rather suspect. Such views have persisted on varying levels into modern times, and not just amongst the puritanical or the late Victorian. Sigmund Freud had difficulty as a scientist in acknowledging an angelic side in his patients. He reframed the conflict as one involving human bodily nature and the probably superstitious religious and moral beliefs they maintain. This wrestling match between the instinctual ID and the moralistic superego was refereed by the central ego. So it continues a bit on. I'm not going to read the entire thing. It does go on to say, ultimately, though, at least among psychology, what is always important is to get the individual unstuck, to empower the central ego to be able to choose, to act more decisively through becoming conscious of its dilemma. The Italian psychiatrist, Robert Assagioli, wrote of the pull between the lower and higher unconscious, once again recognizing an earth-heaven dichotomy. He developed a therapy that sought a psychosynthesis of the two opposing forces, paving the way for the discovery of one's unifying center. Similarly, Carl Jung described the marriage of Eros and Logos within the soul, with the sometimes alchemical participation of the ego. That would be what we know today as shadow work. Okay. Some of these more spiritually inclined psychologists share with Rudolf Steiner the recognition that it is a synthesis of the two poles and not the choosing of one over the other that frees us for self-development. Humanity has both an earthly and a heavenly mission, tasks in the outer world as well as the inner, necessitating an acceptance and embracing of both our natures. In examining this predicament of living in two worlds, Rudolf Steiner, by virtue of his capacity for spiritual research, went much further than previous researchers. Steiner was able to not merely speak of opposing psychological forces, but to relate these specifically to the influence of mighty spiritual beings, Lucifer and Ahriman. The influence of these beings is not to be thought of as limited to the realm of the soul, but rather taken in the widest context as encompassing human evolution, history, and almost every aspect of our existence. The name Lucifer comes from the Latin meaning bearer of the light. One's childhood picture of Lucifer as a slithering manifestation of evil is difficult to reconcile with the beauty of this name. Lucifer, however, represents a force that paradoxically can combine beauty, and if you will, beauty gone too far, to the extreme of decadence, hence to evil. In the Greek legend, Icarus and his father Daedalus escape from the tower of their island prison with wings fashioned of wax. Despite his father's warning, Icarus becomes enamored of his newfound power and of the beauty of the sun. He flies up to the light and heat. His wings melt and he falls to his death. The wiser and more restrained Daedalus keeps his flight balanced between heaven and earth, thus succeeding in his escape from bondage. The Greeks were very aware of the temptation of Lucifer. In most of their tales of tragedy, hubris or overweening pride was the source of a hero's downfall. In Rudolf Steiner's sculpture, The Representative of Humanity, Lucifer is portrayed as an exceedingly handsome and powerful winged form. Despite his having fallen from heaven, he was nevertheless an angel, a leader of angels. As the light bearer, he has particular gifts for humankind, especially that of wisdom, the gift he first offered to Adam and Eve. By their eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, Lucifer promised that they would be, quote, as gods. Like Icarus, they were not yet prepared for such a gift, and ignoring warnings to the contrary, they accepted it and fell from paradise. In this example, it should be noted that the gift in and of itself is not evil. As in our earlier psychological examples, neither the heavenly nor the earthly is of itself to be seen as either absolutely desirable or absolutely forbidden. The beings of the polarities actually have something of value to offer humanity. This is very different from the traditional view of the devil's offerings. However, an individual must be inwardly prepared for the reception of these gifts if they are to be of any value. Excuse me. The hallucinogenic drug user is open to receiving luciferic light and often feels quite wise when in the midst of the drug experience. Without the meditative discipline of the serious student of the spirit, however, the contact with those realms is rarely beneficial and, in fact, is often quite harmful. In this century, society has especially interested itself in the material, partially in response to the excessive rejection of the earth and the body, and of the authoritarianism which maintained this position, we have now fully entered the realm of matter with head, heart, and soul. Whereas in former times, humankind was more dreamy in its consciousness and thus more prone to the luciferic realm of fantasy, illusion, and superstitious thinking. Modern consciousness tends to the concrete, to materialism, the belief only in what can be ascertained by the physical senses and the instruments which extend those senses, binds us to the earth and to the influence of the being named Ahriman. Aingramanu, or Ahriman, was first spoken of in the Zoroastrianism of ancient Persia. He was the evil god, the lord of lies, who tempted men and women to believe that they were solely earthly beings. At a time in history when the clairvoyance, which had once been common, was becoming rare, the ethical teachings of Zarathustra sought to remind the people of their divine origin and to teach through the revelation he had received of the Lord of the Sun, Ahura Mazda. Take a guess on who that might be referring to. The influence of Ahriman has grown through the centuries, quietly gaining respectability in the age of the Renaissance and flourishing in our own century as the predominant worldview. Only in the last years has there been any serious questioning of the notion that the only reality is the physical one. For the most part, the realm of the soul and spirit has been dismissed. The prevailing scientific view has been that only what can be weighed, measured, or quantified should merit serious attention. Ahriman has welcomed statistics as his handmaid. I'm going to go ahead and pause for those of you who have seen a picture of a certain somebody with a book called How to Lie with Statistics. All right, now we'll continue. At the beginning of the century, the Russian philosopher Vladimir Solovyev warned of this danger in his A Short Narrative About Antichrist. In this fictional essay, Solovyev described the appearance of a great individual who taught world peace and became the first world leader, and later, the reuniter of the world's religions. He is a vegetarian and anti-vivisectionist and brings great material prosperity and physical comfort to all who acknowledge his authority, all of this without effort on the people's part. Sound familiar? The world becomes peaceful, even docile, for the minor sacrifice of individuality and freedom. Just making sure you heard the last line. Okay. The influence of Ahriman is seen in the generous gifts that he has bestowed on humankind in the past centuries, and for which we must feel very grateful. All of the technological marvels which science has made possible have given many of us relative freedom from all manner of drudgery while maintaining a high standard of living, freeing us to pursue other interests, giving us more time. Or do we have more time? The great difficulty with our acceptance of Ahriman's bounty has been our relative blindness and lack of foresight, as we have lost ourselves in its enjoyment. The birth of the ecology movement and discussion of the reductionist nature of science has wakened some consciousness of the danger into which we have strayed. Some awareness has arisen as to what we are sacrificing in the Faustian bargain which society has struck, a sacrifice which involves our very humanity. Through Darwin's theory of evolution, as well as through Freud's positing of the sexual as the primary motive of humankind, the idea that we are no more than naked apes has become quite accepted. To this instinctual or animalistic picture of the human, Science has added the model of the human being as machine, with the brain as computer. With such a confining definition of humanity, is it any wonder that we have increasingly come to act and see ourselves as just machines or just animals? The challenge for the individual is often not how to face either Ahriman or Lucifer, but how not to be torn asunder in the encounter with both forces. In T.S. Eliot's play, Murder in the Cathedral, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas A. Becket, is conducted to an examination of himself and his past by a succession of four tempters. The first three attempt to win him with the Ahrimanic enticements of pleasures of the senses, good fellowship, and temporal power for himself and for his church. Becket turns away from these three only to be approached by a fourth tempter, clad like himself as a priest and tonsured. The Luciferic temptation now is offered. The Luciferic temptation now offered is the most dangerous and difficult for Becket, the whisper of spiritual pride, to die in order to attain immortality on earth, to envision the saint's tomb being visited by pilgrims for centuries, to stand high within the ranks in heaven. Only with difficulty does Becket turn away from those, quote, higher voices. In Rudolf Steiner's sculpture, a strong figure stands with one clenched hand upraised to the beautiful Lucifer, the other hand stretched downward to the twisted and sclerotic Ahriman. The representative of humanity stands heroically, holding at bay and in balance the two opposing forces, centered within the third force, that force which we recognize ourselves in the word I. In this series of lectures, Rudolf Steiner strives to deepen our understanding of the two opposing forces, to alert us especially to the dangers of Ahriman, whose wiles have lulled us into a soporific state. The intent, however, is not to drive us into obsession over Luciferic or Ahrimanic demons, but rather to remind us, to reawaken us to our true center. In the words of Henry David Thoreau, we must learn to reawaken and keep ourselves awake, not by mechanical means, but by an infinite expectation of the dawn, which does not forsake us even in our soundest sleep. We recognize that dawn in the figure of the risen Christ, who stands for all of us as the representative of humanity in the modern struggle for the kernel of our being. That introduction was written by Thomas Poplawski. The name of this particular book is called The Influences of Lucifer and Ahriman, Rudolf Steiner, and it says human responsibility for the earth. There was a lot in there, and I was going to do a quick debrief with you. That breaks down most certainly the human condition. That certainly breaks down... did y'all hear a lot of that when it was talking about the appearance of the Antichrist and how unbelievably eerie a lot of that sounded as far as, I don't know, the way certain global leaders are or movements are headed right now? This rabbit hole goes much, much deeper than I'm going to go tonight or that I'm going to read, and likely, actually guaranteed, much, much deeper than I am consciously aware of. But that's okay, because ultimately, this is what ancient teachings have been saying in their own way. Well, maybe not all of them, but a lot for a really long time is the way, or literally all of Taoism, Tao literally means the way, is the middle, not the polarities. And it kind of had me thinking, too, because right now we are in the era of Ahriman. If said prophecies are true, that spirit already incarnated here. It was prophesized long before the internet existed and long before AI was a thing, which that's exactly how these things operate and get in, but that's a different story. Or see earlier posts or resources I include with this one. It was prophesized that, you know, these cycles of the returns and the dominance of certain spirits, whether it's the spirit of Lucifer, whether it's the Christ, whether it is Ahriman, these phases, they're allotted only a certain amount of time. And one of the, of course, there's fallout afterwards, but it was talking about, Ben Saduno mentioned 45 years. And that 45-year period started for Ahriman in the year 2000. It is now 2024. So, yeah. We'll see, but you can also see it everywhere around you. And I was just kind of thinking about it, like, with the polarities, there's really no difference. There's really no difference between, say, an atheist or a religious fanatic. There was actually an example of one of them in that intro where the Ahrimanic forces could not tempt the religious man, but Lucifer almost had him. There's really no difference because they're the extremes. So one person can behave horribly with no conscience because he does not believe that there are consequences. He operates in a manner of dehumanization and has no reverence for anything. And we would call that psychopathy today, but it's really disturbing, and we see a lot of it. And by contrast, of course, this is why a lot of people don't like religion, which, you know, is largely, well, 100% due to the fault of people, not the actual teachings. And even the teachings have been greatly corrupted because of people. So, difference. But take a religious fanatic. Are they capable of committing horrible things? Everybody's heard of stories of, you know, horrible things being done in the name of religion, like name every war. Of course. It's the exact same thing. That person also believes that he is without consequence. Not because there's nothing to provide the consequence, but because he believes himself to be so favored and superior via knowledge, which knowledge without the developed character traits to embody the knowledge is actually very Luciferic in nature. Because of his knowledge or status or whatever, him being air quote right, he believes he is favored. He is right, and he therefore has some sort of cosmic immunity because he has the power to declare it as if he were God. And so both extremes will do equally horrible things. And I have no idea why I came on here to tell you this. I'm gonna go right ahead and just leave it there because I still got stuff to do tonight. But much love to you. And I'll include some videos that get a little bit deeper onto esoteric teachings on this topic. If you feel the need to explore and learn a little bit more. Okay, bye.